promise that. But those who have made anything of this departure, I'm afraid, have made too much. This is but a transition, a passing of the baton. A great broadcaster and gentleman, Doug Edwards, preceded me in this job, and another, Dan Rather, will follow. And anyway, the person who sits here is but the most conspicuous member of a superb team of journalists, writers, reporters, editors, producers, and none of that will change. Furthermore, I'm not even going away. I'll be back from time to time with special news reports, documentaries, and beginning in June, every week with our science program, Universe. Old anchormen, you see, don't fade away. They just keep coming back for more. And that's the way it is. Friday, March 6th, 1981. I'll be away on assignment, and Dan Rather will be sitting in here for the next few years. Good night.
This has been the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite.
That's all the time we have for this edition of Texas Monthly Archives. We invite you next week to once again hear recording library volunteers and staff read articles from the files of the National Magazine of Texas.
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Texas Monthly Magazine, followed by Travelin' Texas at 4.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 77 and clear. Tonight, it will be cloudy with a low in the low 60s. Then, tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the upper 60s. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the low 50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 3 p.m.
It's in Texas. It's in Texas Monthly. Howdy. Welcome to our program. I'm KC Jobe, and this is Texas Monthly Magazine on Sight into Sound Broadcasting. First article will be from our March issue. It's one of our feature articles. It's entitled Surviving Terlingua, when several women in the former West Texas ghost town accused a powerful man of a sexual assault. The backlash was fierce. It's by Leif Reigstad. Section 1. The black stickers started cropping up around Terlingua that fall. They all repeated the same simple phrase, in red capital letters. Katie lied. Several appeared on a pump at a gas station in a tiny far west Texas town. Another was slapped on the back of someone's truck, and one was even spotted in the bathroom of a bar about 80 miles away in Alpine. Katie lied, Katie lied, Katie lied. Everyone in the former ghost town of 110 full-time residents knew who Katie was. Katie Schwartz, a 36-year-old former model with brilliant green eyes, who in July 2019 had told the Brewster County Sheriff's Office that one of the most prominent men in Terlingua, an entrepreneur named Jeff Leach, had pinned her down and attempted to kiss her. The backlash was swift. Schwartz started getting messages on Facebook. A friend sent her a photo of five stickers taped to a wall on what appeared to be one of the vacation rental properties owned by Leach, the same properties Schwartz had helped him manage as his employee and close friend. Not long after, a neighbor sent Schwartz a photo of one of the stickers placed on someone's bare butt cheek. "You're dead in this town," the woman wrote her. "You lied. We all know." In a place as small as Terlingua, it was impossible for Schwartz to avoid those who believed Leach when he said Schwartz was lying, that the encounter had been consensual. Many of Schwartz's friends in town turned on her. One night, she says, a formerly friendly bartender at the Starlight Theater, local bar and restaurant, refused to serve her. Another night, a woman dumped a glass of water into her lap, wanted to smack her in her smug little face, the woman later wrote on Facebook. Then, on September 11, 2019, Leach sued Schwartz for defamation. The ensuing comments on social media were cruel and pointed. Some baselessly accused her of sleeping with the judge presiding over the lawsuit and of being an absent mother. Schwartz thought about deleting her Facebook account, but eventually decided to keep it active so she'd know what people were saying about her. All around her was the vast, empty desert of the Big Bend. She'd never felt so lonely. This is not what she had imagined when she moved to West Texas from Los Angeles 2 years earlier, seeking some form of serenity and rejuvenation. For most of her life, she had been itinerant. When she was young, her family had moved around a lot, relocating from Texas to Florida when she was 6. Her modeling career had started when she was 10, and her teen years saw her traveling the world for gigs. Schwartz hoped to experience a typical senior year complete with a prom, but she struggled to adjust to the conventional, confined environment of high school. When she was 18, she dropped out and moved to New York, where she worked full-time for a major modeling agency and hung out with older models and celebrities, the big shots, as she would later call them. After her career abruptly ended, she resettled in Los Angeles. At 19, she became pregnant, drove with the father to Las Vegas for a quick wedding. Schwartz wore a t-shirt and jeans, and 5 years later got divorced. She shared custody of her daughter with the father. For years, she worked odd jobs from waiting tables to the booking gigs for a valet parking service to managing the office of a mom-and-pop air conditioning company. She eventually translated her love of cooking into a steady stream of private chef and catering gigs that kept her going for a bit, and she longed for something different, a new start. Then one day in May 2017, a childhood friend of Schwartz's messaged her on Facebook with a job offer. Would she want to sign on as the head chef of a wine bar he was planning to open in a little town called Marfa? Though Marfa gained some national renown as an oasis for artists and celebrities, Schwartz knew next to nothing about the place. That suited her just fine. She was ready for a change. Plus, she'd spent part of her childhood in Lewisville, a suburb of Dallas, and she had an affection for Texas. 10 days after visiting Marfa, Schwartz packed her belongings into a Toyota Camry and headed east on Interstate 10. Schwartz was eager to find her place in her new community. She volunteered to help provide meals to seniors at the Marfa Nutrition Center. She painted an Instagram popular Greetings from Marfa, Texas mural in the exterior of a coffee shop downtown. Her daughter, now a teenager, frequently came to visit and loved the town's artsy aesthetic. But Marfa was expensive, and the chef job didn't pay very well. After about 9 months, Schwartz made her way to Terlingua, a historic town just over 100 miles to the south that had fallen on hard times after its quicksilver mine played out in the 40s, only to be reinvigorated in recent decades by an influx of tourists, artists, desert rats, and off-the-gridders. It took just a couple visits for Schwartz to fall for Terlingua's quirky residents and the simple, rugged life the place seemed to offer. Terlingua represented a stark departure from Marfa. While Marfa had become a pricey paradise for hipsters and high-end hoteliers, Terlingua has managed to retain most of its offbeat charm. Every November, tourists fill the streets, many of them unpaved, for the town's chili cook-off, no beans allowed, and peculiar roadside art installations, a metal insect, a submarine conning tower stuck in the ground. In many ways, Terlingua is exactly what you'd expect a former ghost town to be. Scattered across the sun-scorched earth are frames of empty adobe buildings, some reduced to nothing more than dusty masses of rubble, remnants of the hardscrabble community that had once settled around the mine. There's a jail-turned public restroom, a restored church, and a cemetery, its graves marked by crude piles of stone beneath wooden crosses knocked off kilter by wind and time. Less expected are Terlingua's more modern attractions, its bars and restaurants, a proliferation of chic short-term rentals, and a bustling coffee shop with desert views from its patio. An affordable gift shop occupies what used to be the Chisos Mining Company's commissary, alongside a hotel that prominently features its website on its sign. Unexpected luxury in the Terlingua ghost town in the shade of the Chisos Mountains, where great stories begin, the homepage advertises. There is, of course, Wi-Fi. It's not a particularly wealthy place. Most jobs pay minimum wage, and some residences don't have running water or electricity. But in recent years, Terlingua has seen an explosion of tourism, and the short-term rental business has grown exponentially, sometimes to the chagrin of longtime residents who moved to the outskirts of society for peace and quiet, not to suffer through loud Airbnb parties. Jeff Leach is a driving force behind that change. His properties seem to be in a constant state of construction and expansion, and he's one of the area's major employers. Stickers plastered across town display catchy taglines, such as hashtag not like Marfa, that promote his rentals on social media. It was impossible for Schwartz not to cross paths with Leach. A stocky, charismatic man with a background in biology, the 52-year-old Leach had been living in Terlingua for about 3 years, captivating locals with stories of conducting research into the diet of the Hadza people in Tanzania by examining the microbes in their stools. Leach claims to have used a turkey baster to transplant feces from one man into his own gut to see how it would affect his digestive system. The Hadza called him Dr. Shit. By the time Schwartz and Leach met, he was in the early stages of constructing Base Camp Terlingua, a mix of glamping-style teepees and sleek, igloo-like bubble tents, which afford guests unobstructed views of the starry night skies. Base Camp was featured on the cover of the June 2019 issue of Texas Monthly as part of a story about new and improved Texas hotels. Schwartz soon became good friends with Leach's girlfriend, Anna Oakley, and fell in with his close-knit inner circle. Leach offered Schwartz a job at Base Camp, first doing manual labor and maintenance on his properties, then handling reservations, until eventually he made her his personal assistant. Schwartz was impressed by Leach, who spoke to multiple people about the doctoral degrees he had earned and the globetrotting research he had done for the Human Food Project, a nonprofit he founded to study how diet affects gut health. The three friends began to travel together abroad on Leach's dime. He was well known around town for his financial generosity, including high wages, at least by Terlingua standards. Schwartz was earning $15 an hour at Base Camp. According to Schwartz, Leach even offered to let her use his greenhouse so she could grow food to help feed senior citizens in Terlingua. During her L.A. malaise, this was the kind of life she had dreamed about. But as Schwartz would later testify in court in response to the defamation suit filed by Leach, there were signs that Leach was not what he seemed. In an affidavit, Schwartz said she had heard rumors about Leach beating up an ex-girlfriend. Worse, a co-worker told her that another woman, Helen Thompson, a pseudonym, had claimed Leach had raped her. But Schwartz didn't know either woman, and people close to Leach dismissed them as crazy exes. "I brushed it all under the rug because I didn't believe it," Schwartz said. He was doing so much good for the world and for me personally that there was no possible way he was capable of doing any of those things. May 21st, 2019, the night before Oakley and Schwartz flew to Puerto Rico on a Leach-funded jaunt, the three friends were hanging out at Oakley's home, a retrofitted school bus. After Oakley went to bed, Schwartz said, Leach told her that Oakley wanted to have a threesome and that the couple fantasized about Schwartz when they had sex. Schwartz told him she was open to the idea as long as Oakley was okay with it, but according to Schwartz's affidavit, Oakley woke up, heard them talking, became upset, and told him she had not wanted a threesome. The incident made Schwartz uncomfortable, and the feeling lingered for weeks. Not only were Oakley and Leach her best friends in town, but Leach was also her employer. After the Puerto Rico trip, Schwartz reached out to Leach, hoping to talk. "Just want you to know I'm really struggling over here," she messaged him. "Not talking to you about that night and thinking you're mad at me this whole time made me feel so stressed out, and I've had a difficult time focusing on doing my job." Leach replied, "Of course I'm not mad, just a bit confused, was blindsided. But we are all good, we will be fine." Leach messaged Schwartz 2 weeks later, inviting her over to talk about what had happened. Wearing her favorite summer outfit, long white dress with blue flowers, she drove to Leach's place, which she describes as a small, spare house at the end of a steep and winding dirt road. Oakley was out of town for LASIK surgery, so it was just the two of them. They chit-chatted about work while Schwartz used her laptop to take care of some reservations for Base Camp. Leach offered Schwartz a drink, and they moved outside to the porch, where they sat on a tattered couch and talked. She figured Leach had invited her over so that he could apologize in person. Night fell, and the lights from Study Butte were far-off dots in the pitch-black sky. Schwartz's dog, Banjo, was out in the desert exploring. Leach has denied parts of Schwartz's account of what happened next. According to the police report Schwartz filed and her sworn affidavits in Brewster County District Court, Leach began to talk to her about how he was confused about Oakley's desires, that he thought she did want the threesome. Then he pinned Schwartz down on the couch and tried to kiss her. Leach told Schwartz that he wanted her and that he gets what he wants. As she recounted later in interviews with Texas Monthly, as Leach was allegedly straddling her and holding her down by her shoulders, it felt to Schwartz as though time slowed down. and all the bad things she heard about him in the past, the allegations of sexual violence, hit her like a rolling wave. Oh my God, she thought, he's trying to do this to me right now. Because her hands were free, she managed to struggle against him and after a few moments push him off. Schwartz ran to her Jeep, one of the base camp company vehicles, called for Banjo, and drove off. Leach later denied that he had forced himself on Schwartz and said that they had instead just consensually kissed, which he claims Schwartz initiated before she left. In legal pleadings, he has argued that Schwartz lied about what happened that night because he was her best friend's boyfriend. Still in shock, Schwartz knew she didn't want to be home alone, so as though on autopilot, she drove to the Starlight Theater, a place where she'd always felt safe. Schwartz sat on the porch with Banjo and had a few drinks, hoping it would help her sleep. She began to question her emotions. Was it as serious as I thought? Am I making a bigger deal out of this than I should be? And she flashed back to 2002, when she'd been an 18-year-old model in Manhattan. One morning, after spending the previous evening at a high-end club, she awoke in her apartment, battered and bruised, with little memory of how the night had ended. She completed a rape kit at the hospital, and surveillance camera footage from the club later showed that a bouncer had left with her that night, according to Schwartz and her mother, who said she flew to New York to be with her daughter following the alleged assault. The two went to the police, but the case was dropped. Schwartz never knew what happened to her rape kit. Historically, New York Police Department has failed to properly investigate many cases of rape and sexual assault. In 2017, the NYPD said it was looking into the testing status of more than 42,000 rape kits dating back to 1980. The NYPD did not answer questions about the investigation into the alleged sexual assault or the status of Schwartz's rape kit. Her friends didn't believe her, and her agency promptly cut her loose. I would see people on the street and they would pretend they didn't know who I was, Schwartz told Texas Monthly. Her modeling career was over. She soon left New York for Los Angeles, but the trauma followed her. She began to self-medicate with alcohol to keep the memories at bay. I stuffed it down, Schwartz said. I felt like I had to, because when it happened, I was abandoned, and no one believed me. Not the police, not my friends. Now in Terlingua, she was suddenly facing the same difficult choice. Stay silent or speak up. Section 2. A little before 9:30 that night, Leach messaged Schwartz on Facebook. I wish you hadn't left, he said. I know. Shit ain't right, though, Schwartz replied. Or maybe just right. You should come back. We never get this opportunity. We don't have to. And he used a euphemism for having sex. I'm not coming back, Schwartz said. 2 days later, while they were messaging about work issues, Schwartz confronted Leach about that night. Leach wrote that he'd been drinking and had a fuzzy memory. So you don't remember pinning me to the couch and me having to push you off of me and leaving, Schwartz replied. Kinda, Leach said. What are you pissed about? When Schwartz replied to clarify that she was pissed about Leach trying to F me behind my best friend's back while she was having surgery, Leach questioned why she hadn't acted angry the day before when the two messaged and met briefly in person. What's different today? Don't remember trying to have sex with you. What? Schwartz responded. This entire thing between you, me, and Anna has got all screwed up. Much of it I'm confused by, Leach wrote back. Anyway, best not to go near this in the future. I'll do my part, and I apologize if, for the other night, won't happen again. Again, I'm not really clear on everything from the other night, but I take your word for it. Over the next several days, Schwartz confided in multiple people. First, she told Oakley, who Schwartz said became livid and confronted Leach over a Facebook message. Leach allegedly responded to Oakley by saying that he planned to hire an attorney. Then Schwartz told multiple coworkers, including the operations manager at base camp, that Leach had forced himself on her. I was alarmed when I heard the story, the manager said later in an affidavit. The manager no longer works at base camp and requested anonymity because of restrictions about speaking to the press at the manager's new job. I was surrounded by crying employees and trying to remain calm. Meanwhile, according to the manager's affidavit, Leach had been sending employees a flurry of work-related messages, including telling the manager that Schwartz had been demoted. In July, By July 1st, Leach announced that he was going on an international trip. "I'm headed to Canada," he messaged the manager, who shared copies of the Facebook messages with Texas Monthly. Back in a few days, Schwartz was still unsure she should tell the police what had happened. She worried that the fallout would hurt Oakley in particular. Being alone in Tulengua was an unnerving prospect for Schwartz. The nearest hospital was 80 miles away in Alpine, and the nearest domestic violence shelter was 60 miles away in Presidio. And despite its reputation as a redoubt for mavericks, the town had many residents who liked things just as they were. With high-profile women in the media and Hollywood had suffered a backlash after coming forward with allegations of sexual assault, Schwartz thought, then surely the retaliation would be even more intense in a place as remote and isolated as Terlingua. "I didn't know what to do," she said. "Part of me was like, just hold it in." Still, Schwartz wondered, what if there were more women? What if others hadn't been able to fight Leach off? On July 3rd, Schwartz walked into the Brewster County Sheriff's Office. Schwartz reported she only wanted this incident documented, the police report said. Schwartz said later in an affidavit, "I was too afraid to press charges, but I wanted to put it on the record because the incident made me realize that the other rumors about assault by Jeff Leach were probably true, and I wanted to protect myself and others." After filing the police report, Schwartz stayed with a friend in Alpine for a few days, then flew out of state for an extended vacation with her parents. She badly needed a break. Meanwhile, a storm was brewing in Terlingua. Leach returned to town and sent a Facebook message to several of his base camp employees announcing that he would be suing Schwartz for, quote, making false statements to law enforcement and the general public, unquote, and for other false or misleading statements with intent to harm. When Schwartz returned to Terlingua at the end of July, she learned that several Terlinguans who'd initially supported her when she first came forward, including Oakley, had since switched their allegiance to Leach. The Starlight Theater, a bartender, berated her. She said, How dare I come in there? That I'm a liar, Schwartz said. Just screamed at me in front of everybody. In an emailed statement, a representative for the Starlight said she had, quote, absolutely no knowledge nor comment about Mrs. Schwartz or Mr. Leach. But Schwartz's visit to the sheriff's office had had another effect. That same day, Helen Thompson, the woman a base camp colleague of Schwartz's had told her about months earlier, heard about Schwartz's account. The next day, July 4th, Thompson gave a statement to a Brewster County Sheriff's deputy alleging that Leach had assaulted her in 2014 after a consensual sexual encounter had turned violent. Leach has denied the allegations, claiming they had consensual sex and that Thompson, quote, never expressed any complaint to me that was not consensual before the sex, during the sex, or any time after the sex that night. The community seemed to divide into two warring factions, those who believed the women and those who believed Leach. Oakley made clear that she was taking Leach's side. "I don't believe that all men are rapists, and I don't believe that all women tell the truth," she wrote on her Facebook page. "Everyone has suffered in some way from Hurricane Katie." Then in early September, Leach filed a defamation suit, a lawsuit against Schwartz, inflaming his supporters even more. But over the next few months, two more women would come forward with allegations of sexual misconduct against Leach. Would they too face the same public derision as Schwartz? Would the authorities seek justice or brush them off? Part 3. The small size of communities like Terlingua make it particularly difficult for survivors of sexual violence to seek help or speak up without the entire town finding out. Gina Wilcox, the program coordinator and advocate at the Family Crisis Center of the Big Bend, which serves five counties across about 20,000 square miles, told me that women seeking help will park down the block from the Crisis Center in Alpine rather than across the street to avoid being spotted there. "Everybody knows what's going on in your life, sometimes before you do," Wilcox said, speaking generally about the cases she sees in those small towns. "If you do make something public, it becomes fodder for the rumor mill. A lot of survivors, they're embarrassed by that, so they hesitate to report." One of the women who came forward, Elaine Berg, had also been part of Schwartz and Leach's social circle. Berg, who grew up in a North Dakota farming family, had been close friends with Oakley for nearly a decade. and Berg and her husband would frequently host get-togethers at their house in a small town about 100 miles northeast of Terlingua. According to Berg's affidavit, one night in May 2018, while the group was hanging out in Berg's backyard, Leach slid his hand all the way up her shorts and touched her without her consent. It was dark, and according to Berg, no one else noticed. She got up, sat next to her husband. I froze, because no one has ever done that to me, Berg told Texas Monthly. Everybody says, Elaine, why didn't you punch him in the nose? It was just too shocking to me. There were people there. He's intimidating, powerful. I just didn't know how to react. Leach has denied that he touched Berg. The next day, Berg told her husband what had happened, and they discussed what to do. Their friendships were at stake, and Leach had never done something like that to her before. They decided to let it go. But when Schwartz made her allegations, Berg reconsidered going to the police. By then, she had heard rumors of other victims, too. She had talked it over with a lawyer, her therapist, and a counselor at the Family Crisis Center of the Big Bend. On September 10th, Berg filed a police report with the Brewster County Sheriff's Office. 2 days later, she received a cease and desist letter from Leach's attorney, Ray Lifeski, threatening her with a lawsuit seeking all legal damages and costs of court if she continued to talk about what had allegedly happened. In November, the Big Bend Sentinel reported that Lisa Anderson, another of Leach's exes in Terlingua, had in 2017 obtained a temporary restraining order against him that barred him from coming within 500 feet of her residence. Lisa Anderson, whose name is a pseudonym given to protect her identity, has not filed an affidavit in Schwartz's defamation lawsuit. Anderson and Leach had dated for 3 tumultuous years. On 3 occasions, according to police and court records, Leach allegedly turned violent during an argument. In September 2015, Anderson called the police, alleging that Leach had grabbed her and shoved her around before leaving. But the responding deputy said Anderson was uncooperative when he tried to get information out of her. She was extremely evasive and made it clear from her answers that she didn't want to get Leach in trouble and was trying to protect him, the deputy wrote in the incident report. I determined Leach to be the aggressor and placed him under arrest. Leach was ultimately released, and without cooperating witnesses, no charges were filed, a frequent occurrence in domestic violence cases. In a Facebook comment beneath the Brewster County Sheriff's Office post detailing the arrest, Anderson wrote that it was a misunderstanding and said the deputy overreacted. Leach later said Anderson was drunk and yelling at him. He claims he was arrested after Anderson and her brother physically restrained him from retrieving his laptop from Anderson's house. According to Wilcox, there are many reasons why a victim of domestic abuse might not speak out or seek help. Most victims are concerned about retaliation and repercussion within the community, and not always retaliation from the abuser themselves. Sometimes it's from their friends or family or people who are supporting the abuser or the perpetrator, she said, speaking generally about the cases she sees. During a trip to France the following year, according to screenshots of messages between Leach and Anderson that were included in court documents related to the restraining order, Leach allegedly broke Anderson's finger and tooth during an argument. I seem to be the only person in the world you treat so badly, Anderson messaged Leach. You're physically, mentally, and verbally abusive all of the time, even when we were supposed to be having a romantic getaway in Paris together because of the last 4 months when you took off. I apologize for that, and I am sorry I did what I did, Leach replied. It wasn't right, and I know this. We were both hoping we could put this behind us and focus on each other and building our business and life. The shit in Paris is inexcusable and alcohol-driven. He also claimed that Anderson's finger may have been hurt while he was trying to wrest a backpack from him. And we've reached a natural break here in the story, so I'll remind you that you're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on Sight and Sound Broadcasting. This year marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, perceptual disability. You can listen to Sight and the Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on broadcast TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listening at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight and the Sound Radio since 1967. back to our text. This is Alone in Terlingua, feature article. Anderson was also Leach's business partner in their bed and breakfast and boutique hotel company in Terlingua. Their breakup 6 months after the Paris trip resulted in a contentious legal battle over the business. Leach sent Anderson emails calling her a C-word and threatening to punch her in the mouth. Emails were quoted in court documents. As part of a mediated settlement agreement reached in October 2017, Leach was ordered to pay Anderson $110,000, most of it to be dispersed in installments. On the memo line of one of the checks Leach sent to Anderson, he wrote, "Gold digging whore payment plus effing mental anguish." A photocopy of the check was included in court documents. In June 2018, Anderson had left Terlingua and dropped her request to make permanent the restraining order against Leach. In court filings, her attorney wrote that Anderson didn't believe Leach would actually abide by another protective order and that she didn't want to further relive the ordeal of their relationship in pursuit of such an order. As Leach's relationship with Anderson faded in 2017, he began a new relationship with Elizabeth Johnson, a friend of Anderson's who worked as a bookkeeper for Leach's rental company. Elizabeth Johnson is also a pseudonym. She requested anonymity out of fear of retaliation for speaking publicly about Leach. As she later said in her affidavit, Johnson knew that Leach could be violent. She said Anderson would sometimes visit her house in tears, confiding in her friend that Leach was grabbing her and pushing her and throwing things. Johnson thought Leach could really kill her eventually. According to Johnson, when Anderson was out of town, Leach made advances toward her, even though she'd just gotten out of a long-term relationship, and managed to convince her that his behavior was Anderson's fault. "He's a predator," Johnson said. "He took advantage of my being weak in that time. I just wanted someone to love and respect me and to be kind to me, and he did those things. He was kind to me." And then, one night in the summer of 2017, Leach allegedly penetrated her without her consent, according to an affidavit Johnson later filed in support of Schwartz's defamation defense. "I felt like I was becoming an outlet for his anger," she said. After Johnson and Leach broke up, she became super reclusive, rarely going out in public. "I crawled into the deepest, darkest hole I could find," she said. At one point, she confided to a friend that Leach wasn't a nice guy and that he'd mistreated her. "He just kind of wished it away and said, 'Oh, get over it,'" she said. "That only solidified my feelings that I should just keep my mouth shut and not tell anybody anything." In the month after Leach sued Schwartz for defamation, Johnson weighed whether she should come forward. She had seen the Katie Lied stickers around town and had heard people badmouth Schwartz and Berg. She thought it wasn't right that Schwartz was being made out to be the villain. Johnson reached out to a mutual friend and told him to let Schwartz know that she would consider talking about what had happened. On a chilly day in late January 2020, Johnson was sitting at her booth at the farmer's market in Terlingua. Schwartz walked over, introduced herself, and asked if they could talk. As they sat together on a couch, Schwartz started shaking with nerves and her eyes filled with tears. She didn't know what to expect from Johnson. All she'd heard about her was that she was another one of Leach's crazy exes. Still, Schwartz had to ask, would Johnson talk to her attorney, Jody Cole? Johnson readily agreed, and at the end of their conversation, the two women hugged. Johnson contacted Cole the next day and filed an affidavit in support of Schwartz's defamation defense. She was the third woman to come forward with allegations of sexual misconduct in response to Leach's suit against Schwartz. "When I first heard about what was going on with Katie and the other women involved in this case, I wanted to reach out because I felt that I could make a difference by sharing my story," Johnson said in the affidavit. "I had serious reservations, though, because I am worried about Jeff threatening me with litigation or physically harming me. I care about the other women involved in this case. Nobody should be treated that way. I don't want to be afraid of him anymore." In defending Schwartz against Leach's defamation suit, lawyers argued that his reputation was so poor that nothing Schwartz said about him could cause him further harm. Allegations raised even more questions about Leach's background and credibility. Section 4. Long before Jeff Leach arrived in Terlingua, he lived in a double-wide trailer in Austin while attending Westlake High School, located in one of the city's most affluent enclaves. He was a good athlete, according to his half-brother, Perry. Leach played on the storied Westlake football team, which has produced such NFL players as Drew Brees and Nick Foles. According to Perry, Leach's parents, now deceased, were inattentive and allowed him to drop out of school his senior year. I asked my dad, why'd you let him do that, Perry remembered, and he said, well, he wanted to do it. Nobody put any restraints on him. He always got what he wanted, and there never seemed to be real consequences. It's unclear whether Leach graduated from college. At some point, he moved to El Paso, developed an interest in archaeology, and began working as an archaeologist at Fort Bliss, where he helped preserve artifacts left behind by Native Americans who had lived on the land now claimed by the U.S. Army. Colleagues there remembered him as charismatic and hardworking, eager to take the lead on projects, but, according to two of his former supervisors, he didn't have the formal archaeology education that many of his peers did, and there were questions about the quality and ethical rigor of his research. One supervisor, Glenn DeJarmo, remembered Leach as a rogue employee, and another, Galen Burgett, said his field work was largely unusable because he didn't know what he was doing. In September 1995, Burgett wrote a letter in support of a female colleague of Leach's alleging that Leach had submitted a paper to the American Antiquity, a scholarly journal that plagiarized her work. The individual in question is one of the most unscrupulous, dishonest, underhanded scam artists I've ever had the misfortune of having to deal with in my 15 years as a professional archaeologist, Burgett wrote. The letter does not name Leach, but Burgett confirmed to Texas Monthly that he was referring to Leach. Neither Leach nor his attorney responded to requests for comment about his time at Fort Bliss. In 2000, after his stint at the Army base, Leach started a monthly archaeology and travel magazine called Discovering Archaeology. He had secured about $630,000 from 10 investors, including a sizable investment from Perry. The magazine quickly took off, and Leach soon rolled out additional publications, but the business crashed just as fast. Perry said he lost all of his investment as well as trust in his brother. He couldn't control himself, Perry said. He kept hiring too many people, and we couldn't make payroll, and we couldn't pay the payroll taxes. Many subscribers never received their magazines. Leach had also advertised a travel package for exclusive tours guided by some of the biggest names in Egyptology, including a boat trip down the Nile led by the famous Egyptian actor Omar Sharif. But the trip never happened. Leach blamed unrest in the Middle East and then the 9/11 terrorist attacks. He promised refunds, but they never materialized. Customers' advanced payments went to cover operating expenses, including Leach's salary. Subscribers who never received copies of the magazines, customers who signed up for the travel package, eventually banded together and convinced the Texas Attorney General's office to open an investigation, which resulted in a 2003 default judgment of $130,000 against Leach. But he didn't respond to the litigation and failed to appear before the judge. In the words of James DeRoss, the lead investigator on the case, he had skipped town by moving to New Mexico. In October 2004, Leach emailed DeRoss asking how he could pay the restitution. I start sending payments your way, Leach wrote. DeRoss never heard from him again. He tried to seize Leach's assets but was denied access to his bank accounts in other states. As DeRoss later explained to me, he had no jurisdiction outside Texas. Leach did not respond to requests for comment about the case. In 2006, Leach and a business partner launched World's Healthiest Pizza, a restaurant in New Orleans. In 2009, with an investment from Dallas billionaire Mark Cuban in hand, Leach and his business partners began to rapidly expand the restaurant chain, now dubbed Naked Pizza, into at least 10 states. An unhappy investor later pointed out that the principals in Naked Pizza failed to disclose the Texas Attorney General's action against Leach, which was required by the franchise agreement. A half dozen former employees remembered the Naked Pizza office as a volatile environment. They recalled Leach's frequent outbursts of anger, particularly toward his young female employees. They said he would regularly berate the women in front of other colleagues. His assistant said he threw a sandwich at her head. Leach did not respond to requests for comment about Naked Pizza. Jesse Hawkins met Leach in 2009 when she was a student at Tulane University in New Orleans. One of Leach's pizza joints was near campus, and Hawkins started working as a delivery driver, moving up the ladder as the franchise expanded. As she worked more closely with Leach, she began to feel uncomfortable with what she saw as inappropriate situations. One evening in July 2011, he invited Hawkins to stay with him at a house he was renting in Arizona. According to Hawkins, while they were sitting together, Leach asked her if she wanted to sleep in his bed that night. She declined. When Hawkins returned to New Orleans, Leach began sending her explicit text, which she shared with Texas Monthly. "Did you try and have sex last week?" Leach texted her. "Excuse me," Hawkins replied. "No." "Really?" Leach responded. "Really." Leach also sent her several photos of two young employees, a woman and a man, that Hawkins described as sexually suggestive. When Leach returned to New Orleans, he promoted the young woman in the photos who had traveled to Arizona with him to a prominent role in the company. Leach's actions caused an uproar among the employees of Naked Pizza. Not long after that, Hawkins said, the key code of the office was changed without her knowledge, which she alleges was an act of retaliation after Leach's co-owners became aware of his texts with her. I felt forced to quit, Hawkins said later. She filed a claim of sexual harassment with the Louisiana Commission on Human Rights. Investigators asked her loaded questions, insinuating that she was at fault, she said, so she ended up dropping the claim. Meanwhile, the pizza business was growing fast, too fast. By 2013, Leach had left Naked Pizza behind, along with some unhappy business partners, moving to Tlingua either that year or the following. According to Cuban, Leach fraudulently used his name to raise money, and several investors were not happy with him. Due to short-lived success of Naked Pizza and the attention it attracted in the media, Leach became a nationally recognized expert on dietary health. In 2012, he wrote an op-ed for the New York Times headlined, Dirtying Up Our Diets, which he was identified as a science and archaeology writer and founder of the Human Food Project. He self-published several books on the subject. At least one was advertised for sale on the Human Food Project's website. On the page, it claimed, 100% of the proceeds go to support our work in Africa and Mongolia. He traveled to Tanzania in 2013 and 2014 to collect fecal samples from the Hadza, an isolated community particularly vulnerable to outsiders because of its status as one of the few remaining hunter-gatherer tribes in Africa, and shared his research with legitimate academic institutions, co-authoring papers with some of the field's biggest names. After his 2014 stint with the Hadza, Leach published a post on the Human Food Project blog recounting the time he had performed a do-it-yourself fecal implant. The post created a lot of buzz, but it also drew criticism from scientists who questioned Leach's methods and intentions. In the New York Times op-ed, science journalist Ed Young calls Leach's microbiome experiment a stunt that was based on faulty reasoning. Still, Leach and his research achieved new levels of publicity. He spoke at the Aspen Ideas Festival and was the lauded subject of a long profile in Science Magazine. It was written about glowingly in The New Yorker. It was featured in a PBS documentary about food based on a book by famed science writer Michael Pollan. The articles often repeated claims that Leach had earned a PhD, though the universities varied from story to story. In court documents filed in 2018 that were included in his lawsuit against Anderson, Leach admitted that he had never earned a master's or PhD, and he couldn't provide evidence that he had received even an undergraduate degree. Meanwhile, the Human Food Project was growing. An early online crowdfunding effort raised $339,000, and between 2016 and 2019, the organization received more than $1 million in grants from charitable organizations, some earmarked for his research on the Hadza. In 2019, the IRS revoked the Human Food Project's nonprofit status. Leach hadn't filed the documents required for financial transparency. By December 2020, the organization's website had been taken down. But by then, Leach had bigger problems. And this is Section 5. As the defamation suit Leach filed against Schwartz progressed, Leach's attorney filed a lengthy response in December 2019 to most of the allegations that had been made against him, alongside affidavits from Leach, Oakley, and three female base camp employees who said they had never witnessed any sexual misconduct from Leach. I did not force myself on or assault Katie Schwartz in any way, Leach said in his affidavit. Any contact between us was totally mutually consensual. As he described it in the affidavit, he and Schwartz played footsies, and then Schwartz approached him and began to kiss him. They were making out for 10 to 15 minutes before she left. Schwartz responded to Leach's allegations by calling them complete fabrications. He denied inappropriately touching Berg and claimed that his sexual encounters with Thompson had been consensual. The response did not address Johnson's allegations. Her affidavit was filed afterward. In her affidavit, Oakley said she had never heard any allegations concerning any assaults by Jeff Leach in the 5 years she had known him. But according to messages she sent to Berg in July, 5 months before Oakley filed the affidavit, Oakley was aware that Thompson was telling people that Jeff raped her and had spoken to law enforcement. By all means, if Thompson was raped, she needs to go to the cops with details and proof or shut the F up, Oakley wrote to Berg, who had just come forward to Oakley via Facebook message about her own allegations of sexual misconduct against Leach. Thompson's notoriously known as a crazy person and obviously just as manipulative as Katie. Also attached to the filings were messages from Schwartz in the days following the alleged assault, including one that Schwartz sent to a co-worker an hour after the alleged assault, in which she described a good talk with Leach punctuated by a thumbs-up emoji. There's also a photo of Berg, Schwartz, Oakley, Leach, and two other women together on a bed at Berg's house, smiling, taken a few weeks after Leach allegedly put his hand up Berg's shorts. Leach's response seemed meant to suggest that the women had not acted in the manner one would expect of victims of sexual violence. But according to Gina Wilcox at the Family Crisis Center of the Big Bend, there is no typical response to sexual or gender-based violence. What we do see a lot of times is that people try to put on a face of normalcy, she said. They don't want to be seen as a victim, so they'll try to continue on with business as usual. Schwartz responded with another affidavit explaining the messages. I was in shock and unsure of what I should do, so I decided my best course of action was to act as normal as possible, she said. I was also afraid to lose my job and of Jeff's violent tendencies. I did not feel like I had a choice not to be nice and friendly at first. Jody Cole, Schwartz's attorney, said, they really trotted out all of the slut-shaming things they possibly could do. That is just capitalizing on those archaic stereotypes of how trauma affects us. In early February 2020, a judge dismissed Leach's defamation lawsuit. Two weeks later, I emailed Leach to ask for an interview. I told him I wanted to hear his side. He replied that he would be glad to chat and said he and Oakley were currently in Austin, where I live. I'd be delighted if you came to our little place over in Lakeway, Leach wrote, referring to the generally well-to-do neighborhood that sits on Lake Travis. Easy to spread out, and I have a coffee pot. He ended the message with a smile emoticon. On February 25th, the day I was supposed to meet Leach for the interview, Leach's attorney, Ray Lifesty, called me and said that Leach had to return to the Lingua to handle some unexpected issues with his properties. As we talked, Lifesty asked me if I'd researched Schwartz's background as extensively as I had researched Leach's. He asked if I discovered that Schwartz had a felony charge for possession of marijuana. I had. She'd pled guilty to a Class A misdemeanor. Told me that Leach had no idea what I was referring to regarding alleged misconduct while he was at Naked Pizza. Lifesty characterized the women who came forward in Terlingua as being upset that they were being broken up with by Leach. They were disgruntled, Lifesty said. They were jilted girlfriends who now are coming forward much after any of these events. I asked if he had information that could help determine the credibility of Leach's accusers, but he declined to provide any. He acknowledged that the sexual assault allegations against Leach were serious and should be investigated. However, he added that what if those stories are totally wrong and Mr. Leach loses his profession, his job, his companies, his reputation, all based on false allegations? What if those are false? Lifesty didn't respond to any of my questions after that conversation. That same February day, Leach was indicted on a second-degree felony charge of sexual assault of Thompson. He was arrested 4 days later. During a virtual hearing in December 2020, Leach told the court he had rejected a plea offer and the case is expected to go to trial this summer. Meanwhile, no new charges have been filed. Sandy Wilson, who served as the district attorney for Brewster County when Leach was indicted, said in an email June 2020 that the other women had accused Leach of groping or attempted rape, acts that had for years been characterized as Class C misdemeanors under Texas law. That law changed in 2019 when the legislature passed a bill creating a new criminal offense called indecent assault, which includes unwanted touching with the intent to arouse or gratify the sexual desire of any person. State lawmakers heard sexual assault survivors describe feeling unprotected by law enforcement after being groped or otherwise sexually touched without consent. One advocate for survivors described the penalties of the original laws amounting to little more than a speeding ticket. Now a Class A misdemeanor, the offense carries the possibility of up to a year in jail and a $4,000 fine. Wilson said last year that she planned to use the additional allegations against Leach to strengthen the prosecution of the Thompson case. They will be used as bad acts during Leach's trial to show how he operates, Wilson said in an email. When you only have one outcry as an adult, it is a toss-up for a jury. But when several women who did not know each other speak out, credibility increases. But in March 2020, Wilson was defeated in a Republican primary. Her replacement, Ori White, was sworn in on January 4th. Wilson, who had worked as an ER nurse for decades before she attended law school and became a lawyer, told Texas Monthly in February that her four-year tenure as DA had been a constant struggle to work within what she called a good old boy system. It was just hard because they discounted everything I said, she said. It took me twice as long to get anything done. Wilson said that her attempts to prosecute cases involving sexual misconduct or the mistreatment of women were typically met with resistance from local law enforcement. It was a particular struggle, she said, to convince the sheriff's office to pursue an investigation into Leach. They didn't think it was important, but they thought that girl's full of shit, she said. They were like, who cares? It happened in 2014. the sheriff's department just was not interested in working that case. They just don't take crimes against women that seriously, she added. I'm glad I'm out. You can only fight that so long. Let me tell you, it's hard when you're the only one trying to do the right thing and everybody is against you. Last section, section 6. News of the indictment did little to shake the faith of Leach's supporters. When I spoke to about a dozen of them last summer, they offered a wide range of reasons for the continued backing of Leach. One person implied that the criminal indictment happened only because Wilson was up for re-election. Others speculated that the allegations were largely orchestrated by a competing business owner in Terlingua. No one had hard evidence of these supposed conspiracies, though they were quick to suggest Schwartz had a sordid, deceitful history and shouldn't be trusted. I think that she was making advances toward him and was rejected, said Jim Ezell, an organizer of Terlingua's annual chili cook-off. I think she was a woman scorned. I hate the way that many of his dreams were shattered, says Les Hall, a part-time resident of Terlingua, who had known Leach for a little more than a year. It was just pure spite. He's more the victim, in my opinion, said Fran Brothers, a longtime Terlinguan who had recently moved to Arizona. During our short phone call, she said she'd never talked to Schwartz. Several of Leach's supporters tried to convince me not to write this article, saying it was a bunch of small-town gossip. Those who did talk on the record spoke of how generous Leach had been to his neighbors, how he'd given them financial support at some point, how he employed them or their friends and family, that he paid a good living wage. They spoke of how the Jeff Leach they knew was incapable of the sexual misconduct described by his accusers. They said the women must be motivated by greed or jealousy. They questioned why victims like Berg had waited so long to go to the authorities. They characterized Schwartz as a liar, said that she drank on the job at base camp, and accused her of being promiscuous and untrustworthy. They suggested that she had a criminal past, doesn't pay child support. Schwartz said this is not true, and had made the allegations because she was worried about losing her job. They expressed disdain for what they felt was unfair coverage by the local media, pointing to a February 2020 article about the sexual assault allegations in Science magazine, which raised questions about Leach's scientific work as evidence that the allegations were ruining Leach's life outside their small town. Airbnb removed Leach's rental listings from its website, citing the company's policies on sexual misconduct. University of California, San Diego, which had partnered with Leach in his microbiome research, edited part of a 2018 press release touting one of Leach's major journal articles so that the release no longer refers to him as having a PhD. Meanwhile, he has appealed the judge's dismissal of his defamation suit against Schwartz. Since Johnson came forward, she said she gets the occasional eye roll at the grocery store or gas station, but she said it doesn't bother her anymore. Nobody cared when I disappeared in the community, when I fell off the face of the earth, she said. Nobody came to look for me to see how I was doing or check on me. I'm not going to let their little scare tactics and their childish bullying prevent me from talking. I'm tired. I'm tired of being afraid and being worried about what people are going to say. Johnson said she hoped I'd have the chance to talk to Leach and his supporters so that the story wouldn't appear to be one-sided. She expressed frustration that so many people seem to blindly support Leach. I wish that people would just wake up and ask themselves, what makes us the bad guy, Johnson said. I don't understand that. When Perry heard about the allegations against his half-brother, one detail in Schwartz's accounts stuck out to him, that Leach had allegedly told her that he gets what he wants. When I read that, I thought, okay, that's Jeff, Perry said. I believe this woman, and I don't even know who she is. In September, Schwartz moved to Georgia to work at a nursing home, where she cooks Southern comfort food for about 100 residents. I make cornbread every day, she said. The job was a chance for her to do the kind of work she badly wanted to do for years. It was also a chance to get away from Terlingua, where the reminders of her trauma were everywhere. Schwartz also underwent eye movement desensitization and reprocessing therapy, an increasingly popular form of psychotherapy for those struggling with post-traumatic stress disorder. The therapy, which is recognized by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, has helped her head off some of the violent reactions she's had to what she experienced, enough so that she plans to move back to the Big Bend region and use her experience in Georgia to start a program to feed senior citizens. She's not sure she'll return to living full-time in Terlingua, but she has no regrets about coming forward against Leach. He's been getting away with stuff for way too long, Schwartz said, and it needs to be over. Next up, and our last item for the day, is a short piece from The State. This is Style and Design. It's made in Texas by Michael Hall. It's about first string, and the maker is Collings Guitars, located in Austin, Texas. Lyle Lovett plays a Collings guitar. So do Keith Richards, Patti Smith, and George Strait. Prince played a Collings at one of his final shows. Each instrument, acoustic or electric, is made of wood from around the world. Think ebony, Indian rosewood, and spruce. At the Collings Guitar Workshop just west of Austin. Wood is seasoned for months or even years before employees cut it, carve it, sand it, brace it, bend it, assemble it, and lacquer it, depending on the piece. We suffer every little detail, says Steve Nall, head of production. The result? Guitars with a clear, warm, emphatic tone. Founder Bill Collings died of cancer in 2017, but his instruments live on, made by craftspeople who share his passion for precision. And that kind of conveniently brings us to the end of our reading for today. You've been listening to Texas Monthly Magazine, Saturday afternoons at 5 and Monday afternoons at 2. Sight and the Sound Broadcasting, your.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Travelin' Texas, followed by Texas Gardener at 4:30.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
The Midland Health Department is providing clinical services by appointment only. Appointments will be scheduled from 8:15 a.m. to 3:45 p.m., Monday through Friday. In addition, the Health Department will have an immunization clinic, 8:15 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday. Appointments are required for immunizations. To schedule an appointment, call 681-7613.
Now airing on the noon book hour, A Dog's Way Home by W. Bruce Cameron. This is a remarkable story of one endearing dog's journey home after she is separated from her beloved human. With 400 miles of dangerous Colorado wilderness separating one brave dog from her beloved person, Bella sets off on a seemingly impossible and completely unforgettable adventure home. A Dog's Way Home is a beautifully told, charming tale that explores the unbreakable bond between us and those we love. This is a fantastic and exhilarating journey of the heart that brilliantly speaks to the incredible power of love and resilience of spirit that tie us together. A Dog's Way Home by W. Bruce Cameron, weekdays at noon and 2 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read by listening.
Morning, sunshine. So happy to be my love and me as we sing our early morning singing song.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 78 and clear. Tonight it will be cloudy with a low in the low 60s. Then, tomorrow mostly cloudy with a high in the upper 60s. Tomorrow night partly cloudy with a low in the low 50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Lynette McGlamory, and I'll be reading Travelin' Texas here on Sight and Sound Radio. For today's program, I'll be reading articles from the March issue of Texas Highways, and I'll start out with the Open Road essay for this month, and it's titled At Home on the Road: The Pandemic Inspires a New Mom and Dad to Embrace RV Life by Laura Prescott. She's perfect, I told my husband Matt when he first showed me the listing in August. A few days later, she was in my driveway in Austin. A 16-foot 1967 Yellowstone Cavalier travel trailer with white metal paneling and a thick gold stripe that reminded me of the West Texas landscape. She was a beaut. I imagined her as a time capsule from a bygone era, parked majestically by the Grand Canyon, or perched on the shores of Port Aransas, or nestled deep in the Great Smoky Mountains. Her original features were intact: the American Eagle emblem next to the door, for Mike a table that converted into a bed, olive green gas stove, propane refrigerator, and original heat lamp. An old promotional brochure I found online marketed the Cavalier as tops for traveling. I was sold. The RV had been restored by two entrepreneurial young men out of San Antonio with serious carpentry skills and marketing acumen. They tore out the bathroom, built a long bench that slides out into another bed, put on a new roof, fixed a water-damaged wall, gave the interior a fresh coat of white paint, and made sure the water and electricity were in working order. Over the old vinyl floor, they installed 100-year-old pine boards, apparently salvaged from a home owned by famed San Antonio architect Atlee Ayers. They listed the Cavalier with staged photos that would appeal to the Instagram set, complete with a felt letterboard sign that read, "Awaken Your Soul's Adventure." The sign was corny. The rest was exactly what we needed. After handing over a check, the men unhitched the Cavalier from their white Ford F-150, and just like that, we were RV people. Our kind have existed since the early 1900s. In 1915, the Conklin family of Huntington, New York, set off for San Francisco in one of the first known motorhomes. The custom-built 25-foot, 8-ton vehicle was equipped with a generator, full kitchen, phonograph, pull-down bunks, and even a rooftop garden. The cross-country trip garnered national media attention, and soon this unique home on wheels became a trend. By the 1920s, the simplified tent trailer was the popular choice, as more and more people set out to see the country. In the 1930s, the tent trailer evolved into the covered wagon, which had the signature boxy look of an RV. Nowadays, there seems to be an RV that suits anyone's tastes and needs, including motorhomes, camper vans, caravans, fifth-wheel trailers, pop-up campers, and truck campers. Before that moment in our driveway, we didn't know we were RV people. While I love to travel, if given the choice between a campsite and a nice hotel room, I'd go with a nice hotel room 99% of the time. Matt and I had to cut our last camping trip short because I couldn't sleep in the tent. If you would have asked me a year ago if I was in the market for a vintage camper to drive across the country because it was the safest way to travel during a global pandemic, well, you get the point. The world had changed. We had changed. Back in February, a few weeks before the country shut down, we adopted our newborn son, James. The plan was for our parents, siblings, aunts, uncles, and close friends to fly to Austin and see the newest addition to the Prescott clan. They take him on walks so we could rest. They pick up around the house. they'd make us soups and lasagnas to freeze. And they dote on little James, introducing him to his large, loving network of family and friends. Instead, he spent the first 9 months of his life in lockdown. Other than a few hours spent each day at the home of our neighbors, Jaylene and Jeff, and visits here and there with a few friends in our quarantine pod, it was just the three of us, which was fine for a while. But James quickly began to grow and engage more with the world around him, becoming curious and cuddly and increasingly social. We decided that if he was to spend time with that big loving family thousands of miles away, we needed a plan B. Flying was out of the question. As for a road trip, the idea of a hotel, let alone several of them, didn't exactly seem safe. How could we change diapers in the back of our packed Toyota RAV4? And what if James hated being in the car? The longest we'd driven him up to that point had been 15 minutes to his pediatrician appointments. What if he freaked out? Then we freaked out. Then we were parked on the side of the road somewhere, all freaking out together in a cramped car. There were enough what-ifs to put off our plans. But as time wore on, and it became clear the world wasn't going back to normal anytime soon, Matt proposed renting or buying an RV to drive to our families in Pennsylvania and Maine. We could camp along the way, make and eat all our meals in the camper, not come into contact with many people, and also be able to pull off at rest stops to feed and change the baby in comfort. I liked the idea of bringing our little bubble on the road, our pod traveling inside a pod. So Matt set off to research RVs. Unfortunately, we weren't the only ones with this plan. According to the Recreational Vehicle Industry Association, North American RV sales rose 4.5% in 2020, likely due to the pandemic. And Outdoorsy, the online RV rental marketplace, saw a significant increase in bookings from the prior year. Skeptical about flying, travelers were setting out on the open road. There's something undeniably American about a cross-country road trip. In the 1920s, F. Scott Fitzgerald and his wife Zelda drove a 1918 Marmon, dubbed the Rolling Junk, 1,200 miles from New York to Zelda's Alabama hometown to have a breakfast of biscuits and peaches. Jack Kerouac crisscrossed the country in the 1940s, seeking thrills, jazz, and an alternative way of life. John Steinbeck set out with his standard poodle, Charlie, to discover America in 1962, and the list goes on. I love the romance of an adventure on the open road. Some of my fondest memories in my marriage have been on road trips. The time we drove to Yellowstone and got caught in a freak snowstorm at the top of a mountain. Or the time we drove through Minnesota and the police stopped us for taking a late-night photo of the world's largest otter. Or the time we drove to South Padre Island to see the baby sea turtles hatch and make their way to the ocean. We love being on the road, where you can discover new places you'd miss if you only flew over them. We even drove 3,000 miles across South Africa for our honeymoon.